The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets start the year on an upbeat note. Trump tweets nonstop. Manufacturing around the world sees gains in December, and our guest today is John Williams, founder of ShadowStats.com. All this and much more on episode number 491 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to 2017. This is Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So happy that you're with me this year and in the 8 or so years that we've been doing this so far nonstop. We have had some amazing guests on over the years, and hopefully you have the opportunity to listen to many of them, some of their insights, some of their wisdom, and some of their market calls that we've had that have been really, I think, pretty interesting and informative, educational, as well as profitable. That's some of the reasons why many people listen to this show. So hopefully you're here to do so too. If you're new, welcome aboard. By the way, you can follow me on Twitter. One of the best places to find information about what we're talking about, what we're thinking, is to follow us on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is the tagline there, the hashtag or the Twitter handle, whatever you want to call it, on Twitter. Of course, thedisciplinedinvestor.com also has a lot of information. We wrote up something last week about gold towards the end of the week, about where the potential breakout was, what we were looking at, why we were looking at the gold miners. We had talked about that on Twitter before. So if you were looking to get in on a really great trade that actually occurred last week and the week before, which was the gold miners, which ramped up as the price of gold moved. And then we kind of did a reflection of what we had talked about through the charts and the technical analysis. Well, you could have followed us on Twitter, found out about that, then found out about where the price levels were in terms of the breakout and resistance. And then we even tweeted on Friday that we closed the position just the day before and had, I don't know, something like, I think it was a close to a 55% profit in about a week and a half. Point is that there are plenty of ways to profit from this show, plenty of ways to find out more information, to get education, and thedisciplinedinvestor.com is the place that you want to go. As a matter of fact, if you want to get regular emails when we post something, each day there's a summary of the things that we post, whether it's maybe the DH Unplugged podcast, the Disciplined Investor podcast, a write-up that we have on the blog. Just sign up for the email list, and that's very easy to do on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. To the bottom right, or maybe a pop-up will show up, and you'll get a daily summary of what we're talking about. Not all days, but some days. Let's go into some of the things that we are looking at right now before we get to our guest. But I got to tell you, there's definitely still some concern about the high level of the US dollar. That did, in fact, come down pretty significantly last week into the jobs number. And the concern that is going to now play out appears to be that, you know, we have a earnings season that's about to come up. We'll talk about that in a second. But earnings season is right around the corner. And a lot of stocks have moved up dramatically post-election to a point that, you know, who knows where valuation lies right now. But from everything that we can see, valuation is a little bit hot. Definitely the forward PE is somewhere about 17. You look at the CAPE ratio, that's towards a relative high. You look at PEs backwards at 23 or so, going back 12 months. In other words, the forward versus the backward PE. Now, what does that mean? Well, with the US dollar still above 102, peaked out at 103 and change, but above 102, is this going to provide significant headwinds for many of the multinationals and many companies in the US that do business abroad? I dare say, yes, that is going to. The question is going to be, how do investors deal with this? Because we're going to be seeing earnings come out, probably going to see a lot of conversation about constant currency and currency headwinds. And what if the currency wasn't this high, but this is what it is, and our outlook on that. The question is going to be whether or not we're going to be able to see an offset for the potential for lower corporate taxes in the future to say, okay, well, we do see that companies are having a bit of a trouble with their sales, with their profitability, with their margins, due to the fact that there is this much higher dollar over the last quarter. But will investors actually say, you know what, it's okay. We think, we have heard, we're hoping for a tax break going to come into play sometime in 2017. And if in fact corporate taxes go down from, let's call it, the mid-30s down to 20s, well, who cares? That's such a break that it doesn't matter about the currency headwinds. There's going to be so much more profitability. Margins will grow dramatically due to the fact that there's going to be much lower taxes paid, that this currency headwind not going to be a problem. But we'll see if that actually occurs. That's going to be something very important to look at, how actually the stocks react, particularly those stocks that have been really moving up into earnings, once we see that there is this conversation that is undoubtedly going to happen. Now, speaking about earnings, the official earnings season usually starts with Alcoa. That's on the 15th of January. But next week already, we're seeing that towards the end of the week, there's some earnings in the beginning of the week, but towards the end of the week, there's going to be the beginning of some of the big names that are going to be coming out, particularly the banks. We got Bank of America on Friday, BlackRock. We got Infosys, Infi, which is actually an Indian company, but they are a pretty major technology company. We have JP Morgan, Chase, PNC, and Wells Fargo all on Friday before the market opens. So that's going to be the start of it. And then the following week, we'll start to see the technology companies, and we'll see just all of a sudden the earnings start to fly in like crazy. Now, we did see, as I mentioned, some better than expected manufacturing numbers, the service sector as well. Last week, in fact, we saw that auto sales, let's see what auto sales. We had auto sales about 5.3 million, truck sales about 9.25 million. Actually, still seeing a lot of sales going on there. There's been a concern that auto sales would slow precipitously, but that really hasn't happened as of yet. Construction spending was up last week. The ISM index was 54.7, and the consensus was for about 53.6. Last month was 53.2, so that was a much better number on the ISM index. And then we saw also the ISM services index tick up to 57.2. which was exactly the same as the prior month, but just slightly above expectations. That's what people were looking for. Of course, the big news last week was the employment numbers. And we saw that non-farm payrolls totaled 156,000, non-farm private payrolls 144. These were a bit lower than anticipated. The expectation was for about 175 to 180 on the non-farm payrolls, so about 30,000 or so short. Hourly earnings, though, did move higher. Hourly earnings last period was negative 0.1%. They moved up by 0.4%, showing that there is some wage growth that is occurring. And the average work week has been maintaining steady at about 34.3 hours per week overall. Factory orders didn't do so well. Factory orders actually ticked lower. And that probably, I would say, is reasonably expected after the holiday season. After all the merchandise was ordered and the factories ramped up, and now all of a sudden we're dealing with the leftovers. And of course, stores not putting in big orders at this point, saying, you know what, maybe we'll slow down, sell what we have, put it on sale, get rid of it, and move forward, you know? But there is some important things coming out on the economic front. So far, not much of it's mattered. We saw that there was a dip on the market on Friday that turned into a gain. The Dow Jones came within like less than a point away from the 20,000 level, which is not a big deal, but it is a big deal in terms of the media and, you know, of course, looking at all of this. So some interesting things happening there. Well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on with President Trump. He seems to be doing a heck of a job of tweeting lately, nonstop tweeting. If you haven't followed him, it's quite impressive how much time this president-elect has been putting towards Twitter. And some of the ways that he's using Twitter as a pulpit for strong-arming companies. Last week we saw that he basically humiliated several companies that are outsourcing or manufacturing out of the country some of their or planning to or currently and looking for them to build or expand manufacturing here in the U.S., particularly the automobile industry. And he was focusing on Ford, and we saw what happened there. GM, he's focusing on directly on the automobile, saying, you know what, they're building in Mexico. Doesn't say anything really about building in Canada, but building in Mexico. And you know what, if you do so, let me tell you something, there's going to be a major border tax that you're going to have to be dealing with. And the companies are caving in. Saw this with some of the defense companies also. Kind of an interesting situation. I'd like to hear what you think about this, how he's going about this, what your thoughts of a president using a strong arm technique through Twitter. In other words, is this something that you think is okay to do? Is it something you think is maybe, as I say sometimes, well, it doesn't seem very presidential. What are your thoughts? Have you thought about this? Is this something that you're okay with? Something that bothers you? Something that you think absolutely shouldn't be done? Something that's against national policy? Maybe even to a point, you know, edging on treasonous as he's talking about various countries and some of the issues with regard to Russia, whatever it is. I'd like to hear what you have to say. What you want, what you could do is send a note to me through the Ask Andrew feature over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. On the top there, there's a little link that says Ask Andrew. Click it and just put your name in there and submit your thoughts on what I think about Trump's tweets. And we'll read some of those on the air in the next coming weeks. Next coming shows. So that should be fun. I'll mention that Harry Dent is our guest next week. He hasn't been here in a while. Harry Dent is a demographic economist. He's also a cycles guy. Some people think he's kind of Mr. Doom and Gloom. That's probably true also. But he's going to be on the show. He has a new book out, The Greatest Sale Ahead. I have to find out the name of it. Kind of an interesting, I started reading it already. I'm going to read it this week. But Harry Dent, if you haven't read his stuff, The Great Boom Ahead and a few other things that he's written over time, again, very interesting, whether or not he is exactly right on his calls and dates. Fascinating discussion about demographic, economic cycles and trends. So he's going to be on the show next week. With that in mind, let's get to our guest this week. And our guest today is John Williams. He's the founder and publisher of ShadowStats.com. He received an AB in economics and cum laude from Dartmouth College and an MBA from Dartmouth Amos Tuck School of Business Administration. And he was also named an Edward Tuck Scholar. And the thing is that he's been around for a while. He's been an economist for 33 years. He's worked with individuals as well as Fortune 500 companies. And he has a great site that we call ShadowStats.com. We'll have the link for that on the website. John, how are you?
Fine, thanks, Andrew. Thank you for having me on your show.
So I had some questions for you. We oftentimes reference some of the materials that you have on your site, and I thought we would just start with a quick explanation from you on, you know, what it is that you're doing on the site, what stats you're bringing up, and maybe then we'll get into how you derive some of those statistics.
Sure. Well, as you noted, I've been doing this for several decades. I found early on that if I had any hope of providing meaningful economic forecasts for my clients, and my clients generally are private, I really had to understand the nature of the government statistics, what was being reported, what was not being reported. I found over time that the what was coming out with a popular number, such as the employment data, inflation data, the GDP data, economic numbers tended to be stronger and seem to be getting stronger over time against what the common experience was, and that the inflation numbers were turning softer than common experience. As I got into the detail, indeed I found there were changes being made to methodologies, generally very open changes. All you have to do is read the footnotes and in the reports, and with the effect of putting upside biases into the economic statistics and downside biases into the inflation numbers. The changes were deliberate. So what I did was try to back out the gimmicks that were being put in and report the numbers on the same basis as they were reporting them, net of the gimmicks, along the lines of common experience. What I found over time is that Main Street USA's got a pretty good sense of what's going on. It's not just the you may have all sorts of hype. You may have occasionally and not only rigged statistics like an occasional real upside boost to GDP that's not there, but where the GDP is consistently overstated, the average guy doesn't believe that. He knows how business is going in his community. And it's Main Street USA's approach and understanding of where reality lies. It's basically, what do you experience? What do you see out there? And that's what Mr. Trump picked up on, that the economy was not as strong as it was being advertised. And he hit home with that hard. And that I think, was a key factor in his overthrowing the system as it had been up to that point in time. He recognized the problem, and there are a lot of people that responded to his recognition of such.
Now, so what is the purpose of, if you're telling me that many of the numbers that are presented are done so in a way and have been, well, we'll use the word manipulated, I guess, in a way to make it look better than it is, right? Is that, that's what you're saying?
Generally, yes.
Okay, what's the purpose?
What's the purpose? Generally, to prop up administrations politically. If you go back to the days of Lyndon Johnson, and I know people or knew people who worked in the Commerce Department at the time, he would review the GDP numbers, or what were then the gross national product, the GNP numbers. He'd review them regularly. If he didn't like them, he'd send them back to the Commerce Department. He'd keep sending them back until the Commerce Department got them right. I kid you not. There have been manipulations over time, generally around politically sensitive times. On the other side of the aisle, if you go to the first Bush administration and the recession in 1990-91, there were people in the administration who moved to manipulate that GDP number. They boosted the GDP reporting outside the system. It was done in the private sector with reporting to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. I knew people on all sides of it who were involved and have confirmed it a number of times. The effect was that the GDP was artificially boosted. The recession was called to an early end. But guess what? Main Street USA didn't buy it. And Bill Clinton touted, oh, it's the economy, stupid. Main Street USA picked up on that, yeah. And they didn't vote for they voted Bush out of office. But Clinton, excuse me. I mean, you've had all this wonderful hype that the economy recovered from its collapse into 2007. Never happened. I mean, I tracked the underlying numbers, and you not only have political gain for incumbent politicians, but the numbers are also used for games being played by the Federal Reserve. And again, a lot of people, just looking at the real world, know the economy hasn't been quite good. Now, granted, you'll have pockets of relative strength and weakness around the country. It's not uniform. But if you look at the GDP, for example, the official version of the economy is that it peaked in late in 2000, collapsed into 2009, and then rebounded. And it's now 11%, 12% above where it was at its pre-recession high back in 2007. That's adjusted for inflation. Now, that's not common experience. Now, there are a number of reasons for that, which we can get into. But I just give you as an example, employment, mm-hmm. also a number that's very heavily inflated on the upside, or the unemployment rate that's deflated on the downside. Employment is up maybe 5% over its pre-recession peak. It's not up 11%, 12%. Industrial production is below its pre-recession high right now by almost 2%. Industrial production accounts for over 60% of the GDP. The manufacturing sector never recovered its pre-recession high. It's down by about 6 percentage points. You look at the housing industry. Well, if it's pre-recession high, depending on the series that you look at, you're down 20 to 60%. Again, never having recovered a pre-recession high. The GDP numbers are a lot of fluff. They have very little meaning. And they had an amazing spike in the third quarter, which gives the current administration a happy exit. But guess what? The reporting of the fourth quarter GDP, which is going to come in probably at a fairly reduced rate of growth initially, maybe turning negative in its ultimate version, doesn't get published until a week after the inauguration.
So one of the things that I don't understand is if let's just say that we are looking at this whole situation, that there is the, as you say, that there's a lot of question as to how this is all constructed and it's really meant to look better and GDP really isn't a lot better, but yet we're seeing a lot more housing sales. I mean, that I don't know how we can really mess with that number too much. We're seeing that housing prices have gone up. We're seeing that there are supposedly, we'll just hold this, hold your breath as I say this, supposedly more people working. There are earnings that are better in corporations. We're seeing that, generally speaking, car sales are up dramatically. And again, there's reasons why that may be and some initiatives that have been made. But if we were to look at just your unemployment data numbers, and I want to focus on this chart for a second here. We'll look at the official numbers, the broadest measure, the U6, and the quote-unquote shadow stats numbers and the alternative. Now, if I look at this chart, it very simply shows me that really we have had zero recovery. As a matter of fact, it may have even gotten slightly worse since 2008. Is that a fair statement?
Well, you have had some recovery. The thing is, what you have had is companies cut back to the bone, and so that you had you had some layoffs that removed a little bit of fat from the system. But generally, we've not recovered much. My contention is that where the headline numbers, the economy collapsed into 2007 and rebounded. My contention is the economy collapsed into 2007. You had some recovery, but it's basically been flat and stagnant. Now it's turning down again. And you see that, for example, in industrial production. The industrial production, again, 60% of GDP, had a brief peak in December of 2014, almost like it was just a one-month peak where it went above its pre-recession high, and then it's been downhill since. Mm. You've seen year-to-year declines there now for more than a year. You've never gone for more than two quarters of year-to-year decline in production in the 100-year history of the series where you've not been in a formal recession. Now, you mentioned a number of factors there. Keep in mind, when you look at the numbers against the pre-recession levels, you're still well down. I mean, housing sales, new home sales, for example, still is down order of magnitude 20% from where it was at its pre-recession high. Mm-hmm. You know, you get ups and downs and all sorts of spikes in the current numbers, and they get revised lower. You look at the year-end auto sales. Yep, there was a big jump, and get all sorts of incentives. We haven't seen the seasonally adjusted data work through in the retail sales yet. But I can tell you that if you look at consumer production, you're looking at this is the consumer goods, which includes the autos. It is you see the sharp fall up and basically stagnant bottom bouncing since. Mm-hmm. There are any number of ways you can look at the numbers and cherry pick the good details.
Of course, yeah, of course.
But the numbers that we're seeing on whole on aggregate are generally not as advertised. And Wall Street is a very big proponent of putting out the good numbers. You say, who wants those good numbers? There's a popular financial network on television. Where I went on, I was predicting a recession at the end of '89, which is about when it started, although it's clocked, I think, in 1990. I was predicting that, and I wasn't hearing anyone else talk about it. But they had me on the air to make my case. But as is their nature, they also had on someone to give a counterpoint, and they brought in an economist from a very large New York City bank. The two of us sat and talked in advance about what our views were. I outlined my case for the recession. His response was, "Well, yeah, that's I think that's fair. I think that's the consensus outlook." I was shocked. I hadn't heard anyone else talking about it. We went on the air. I gave my pitch on why we're heading into recession. He said, "Oh, we're going to have a booming economy in the year ahead." And there's a reason for that. He had to put forth a story that met the needs of his employer. Wall Street has a general bias in terms of putting out good news that helps them sell product. And most of the economic consensus, most of the guys you see quoted in the press are economists put up by Wall Street just to do that. So
I don't sell
consensus. I give people the best estimate I can give.
Let me tell you something. The other thing is I would venture to say that I'm just speculating here, that he was invited back a lot more times than you were.
Yes, he was. What can I tell you?
Listen, on the
unemployment, but they knew what they were getting with me. They knew what I was working. Right. And they did. They those times have become a little less frequent.
Well,
as the circumstances have gotten difficult here.
Right. We know how that goes. Let me ask you something also about unemployment. I want to talk about the unemployment rate for a second. Your shadow stats. There is a question. I have someone who follows you, and we do another show called DH Unplugged. He asked me a question to ask you. Two questions, actually. Have you noticed that the official unemployment rate and the shadow stats unemployment rate had for a long time, they were, while there was a difference, clearly a difference and a spread, they kind of worked, you know, pretty well together, right? You know, the ups and the downs and the basic gyrations and all that. Ever since Obama came into office, there has been a massive separation. And the question is, why is that?
Well, first of all, Obama came into office as the economy was collapsing. It already... He was elected end of 2008. He came in early 2009, which was before the trough and recession. But the employment numbers tend to lag the economy a little bit, and so the employment is just falling apart there. What's happened in this most recent cycle, in this extraordinary economic downturn, that's different from the past. Is something that is highlighted by changes that were made to the reporting methodologies of the unemployment rate back in 1994. Back in 1994, you're looking at the onset of NAFTA. People in the government were expecting that you'd have a fair number of people displaced as production moved into Mexico and such. Production from small towns where maybe you're not going to get full replacement of the jobs. And so they changed the definitions. One of them is an area called discouraged workers. The headline unemployment rate, the one that gets reported in all the press each month, in order to be counted as unemployed there, you have to have been actively looking for work in the last 4 weeks, obviously wanting a job. If you've not looked for work in the last 4 weeks, they don't count you as unemployed. If you've looked for work in the last year, and you still want to work, they will they'll count you as what they call a discouraged worker, and they put you in a broader unemployment measure. So the headline number, what they call the U3, they have six measures. U3 is a headline number. You're counted there as unemployed as long as you've looked for work in the last 4 weeks. Now the unemployment rate simply is calculated as the percent of unemployed versus the labor force. Labor force, very simply, is the number of people who are employed plus the number of people who are unemployed. So if you become a discouraged worker in the headline number, you're no longer counted as headline unemployed. You're moved into the U6 number, as they call it. And if you look at the U6 number, that got up to about 17-18%, and then came back down. It's now at about 10%, where the headline U3 numbers down a little bit below 5% at the moment. What happened there, and the reason the U6 number came down, was that you had a people there are now only counted as unemployed so long as they haven't been discouraged for more than a year. If they've been discouraged for more than a year, they're just excluded from the headline unemployment numbers. Before the changes in 1994, it didn't make any difference how long you'd been as a discouraged worker.
It seems to me if you're not working, you're not working.
I'm sorry?
It seems to me if you're not working, you're not working.
You know, that's right. And if you want a job, that's the way I look at it. What I've done is I've tried to reconstruct what we'd be seeing had they done things the way they did before the 1994 revisions. Again, it's all a matter of definition. But in estimating the displaced workers, and these are my numbers, and I base it on history of the numbers over time, a lot of surveying that's been done here, I've got an unemployment rate that's just shy of 23%. And I'll contend that if you went around the country and asked everyone whether or not he or she was unemployed, you'd come up with a number close to that. I've had people come and say to me, look, that's it's like levels we had in the Great Depression. 25% supposedly was the peak unemployment there. Well, back in the Great Depression, over 20% of the people working were on farms. And today, that's less than 2%. A more appropriate comparison, perhaps, is the non-farm unemployment rate to get up to 35% in the Great Depression. We're not there. It's as bad as we've had since the Great Depression, a little worse than 1970, mid-70s downturn and the early 80s downturn. But in terms of your question as to why the divergence here, what's unique in terms of modern experience is that you're not seeing the unemployment rate plunge because people are finding jobs. That's the happy circumstance. That's what happens in a normal economic cycle. People become unemployed, the unemployment rate rises, they go back to work, the unemployment rate declines. That's the happy circumstance. But when you count, when you calculate the unemployment rate, you can also have the unemployment rate decline because the headline unemployed are, instead of finding jobs, are being defined out of existence. They're no longer being counted in the labor force, the headline labor force. And a lot of that has happened because people have not gotten jobs, but rather have become discouraged. So that when you look at the divergence there, you have the discouraged workers going from the U3 number, which is the old, you know, it's nice and low, into the U6 measure, the broader that includes the people who've been discouraged for less than a year, that's up around 10%. But once after a year, they drop out of that as well. My number picks them all up, and I'm up over 20%. So that's my estimate. And what I'm doing is picking up all these discouraged workers that have disappeared from the system, and it's the drop in the number of discouraged workers more so than people gaining new employment that has resulted in the drop in the headline unemployment rate.
There's a lot that going on there. Let me ask you this. What do you respond to of maybe some critics of yours? Because I've seen some things about this that people say, oh, he uses fudge factors to get to those numbers. What is your response to that?
I don't use fudge factors.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
I mean, they're my estimates.
It seems to me, John, that what you're trying to do is strip out all the nonsense, strip out all the manipulative ways of showing the data and really just presenting the data. Would that be a fair estimate or a fair thing to say about what your numbers portray?
Yes, with the following caveat. Again, it's definitional. What I'm trying to do is to put it back in the form that in the way it used to be reported and defined, the way that people experienced it, where the numbers were more credible. It reflected common experience. I'm trying to come up with numbers that are consistent with common experience. And I'll contend that if you survey people, in fact, there are a number of surveys that show this, the average guy thinks the economy is worse than being reported and that inflation is higher than being reported. And that is, I'm trying to come up with estimates that are consistent with the common experience which I'll contend is largely a matter of redefinition of the series away from common experience into the realm of the politically beneficial.
Mm-hmm. So let's kind of skip ahead real quickly to an analysis that you wrote on the at the end of the year, December 30th, the shadow government statistics. It's a commentary that you write. And you talk about this, an interesting situation here, that there is the potential for a resurgence and the pressure on the Fed to expand their quantitative easing program, which they're saying pretty much, well, you know, what we're really concerned about the inflationary pressures that we're going to see with some of the fiscal policies that may be legislated by the incoming administration. But what you're seeing is that the potential for a big sell-off in the U.S. dollar and some long-range concerns about the solvency of the U.S. Treasury.
Right.
So well, that flies in the face with a lot of what everybody's all cheery about right now, which is stocks are up. GDP came in at a good print. We saw that the ISM manufacturing and the ISM non-manufacturing numbers came in good. The unemployment rate is low. The Fed says, hey, things are getting a lot better. Trump is going to come in with fiscal this, fiscal that, tax breaks, repatriation of assets, you know, U.S.-centric policies, and all the things that right now are being looked at as very much significantly beneficial to the U.S. economy, not to mention stocks.
What the Fed tells you usually is nonsense.
Well, yes,
they have no real interest. I mean, not that it would be nice if the economy was moving along and inflation was contained and everything was happy as it was perhaps at one time. They'll tell you that their mission is to maintain positive economic growth, contained inflation. Those are their primary directives from Congress. The primary mission of the Fed is to keep the banking system solvent. They're the central bank. There's very little they can do at the moment to stimulate the economy. They know that. Bernanke's expressed that commonly. They can create any inflation any time that they want to. All they have to do is debase the dollar, and that will spike inflation because oil prices will rise. Oil prices have an inverse relationship there. The dollar weakens, oil prices rise, gasoline prices rise, and oh my goodness, all of a sudden we've got higher inflation. The upside and the downside to inflation in recent years has been driven about 90% by the movement in gasoline prices. The Fed can move that any time that it wants. So to say, oh, we're trying to get the inflation rate up to 2%, that's nonsense. They could do that any time. Their problem is that the banking system collapsed effectively in the panic of 2008. The Fed, the Treasury, made a very clear decision. I'm not saying I wouldn't have done the same thing. I'll contend we shouldn't have been in that circumstance. Mm-hmm. But they decided to do anything and everything necessary to prevent the banking system from collapse. They bailed out whatever was needed. They guaranteed whatever funds were needed. They bought companies, everything possible to do, irrespective of cost. The problem is all the measures that they took to keep the system afloat, and they did keep the system afloat, were stopgap measures. They didn't do anything to address the underlying problems that had led us there. And right now we still have a banking system that is not operating normally, not lending normally. Their fear is that the economy, weak economy, stresses the banking system, or stresses the solvency of the banking system. More loans go bad. So they talk about a strong economy being important here. It is from the standpoint of keeping the banking system solvent, but there's very little they can do themselves to stimulate the economy. The whole bit about the quantitative easing was never designed to stimulate the economy. What they did was they bought a tremendous amount of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities from the banking system, flooded the banking system with liquidity, but they had the banks redeposit the funds with the Fed as excess reserves where the Fed paid them interest. Had they allowed the banks to put any of that new liquidity into the economy in the way of loans, You would have seen some growth in the money supply and some, and indeed some stimulation of economic activity. But they didn't do that. The concern has been and still remains the banking system and keeping it afloat. And it's not working. The banking system is still not afloat.
Well, but that's the hope with all the potential for deregulation in theory. But I agree with you that the Fed, I think there has been some noticeable change. I think it's been very noticeable that there has been a change in the overall confidence. Now, you have algorithms trading on the Fed numbers and you have all this going on, you know, but I think personally, I think the tipping point was the fact that one, the Fed, which I think we agree with, is terrible at forecasting. They were forecasting 4 rate hikes last year. They did 1 and with all sorts of excuses in between. But the second thing that I think was really very telling was not necessarily here in the U.S., but when Japan and Europe went to a negative rate on their Fed funds rate, if you will, and how that backfired on them so severely.
Yes.
I think there was a realization that, wait a minute, these guys really don't necessarily know what they're doing. They're just playing around, toying around to see how things go, pushing and pulling buttons. And like, what does this do? Oh, if I pull this string, what does that do? And I think the agreement is that I think people do agree that, yeah, there's been a lot of debasing of the currency going on. There had been with the quantitative easing. And we did have them at record low interest rates. And if, in fact, there wasn't the ability for them to spike inflation at this point, when can they actually, you know, and meet their goals and to, you know, increase everything on a GDP basis and all that? When is it going to ever happen? And that's when the realization that all the shenanigans that the bank, companies are doing, pulling with the, you know, lending out. And right now we have more debt outstanding than ever on a corporate basis. And, you know, what they do with that debt? Well, they turned around and bought their own shares back. Why? Is it the best company in the world? No, because they can increase their earnings and all things. So there's a lot of shenanigans being played, right?
Well, guess what? The shenanigans, again, go back to the Fed. Because what I'd like to get through is a point here. I didn't quite get it.
Sorry.
The Fed, what they did with a quantitative easing was bail out the banks. Now, what they used as the excuse was, we're stimulating the economy. The economy's weak, therefore, we're putting forth this quantitative easing. The weak economy provided them political cover because the average consumer wasn't looking to bail out the banking system. What they're doing was bailing out the banking system. Now, the economy is turning down again. You're going to see some weak numbers in the next couple of months. And, in fact, as we're talking, you've seen a down day on the currency amid speculation that maybe the Fed's not going to be quite as active again in raising rates. The whole reason they didn't raise rates last year, they were jawboning it, trying to keep the dollar up. At the same time, they wanted to keep the system as it was. It's still not stable. But if the economy continues to tank, which it's doing and which they're seeing, they need to move back towards quantitative easing. Because it's not because they're looking to stimulate the economy. They're looking to provide some liquidity to the banking system that's going to be under increasing stress. And guess what? You also get stress under the for the Treasury and its funding needs. Right now, the people used to be buying bonds outside the United States are generally selling them. Fed funding needs are going to rise here as the deficit does. And a weak economy widens the deficit. So that what the Fed accomplished with its quantitative easing was not economic stimulus. It was to provide liquidity to the banking system, but in the process and buying up all those treasuries. And they're still holding $2.5 trillion worth of treasuries. They haven't ended quantitative easing. They just stopped active purchasing. They're maintaining that level of $2.5 trillion treasuries. And when they get paid interest by the Treasury, the Fed pays the interest back to the government. They effectively monetized those treasuries, which at the time in which it purchased it was about 3/4 of the new Treasury issuance of the Treasury. The Treasury's going to need some funding help here, and then that'll be another reason for going back into the quantitative easing to help the banks, to help the Treasury, despite, and in fact, actually because of, the much weaker than expected economy. We're not seeing an economic recovery. And that's where the reality is. That's why Trump is in office. You're going to see this increasingly with the headline data, with the employment data. The employment numbers are rigged very heavily with upside biases. But the numbers ahead are generally going to be weaker than expected. The Fed is going to find itself having to move back into quantitative easing, and it's opposed to further rate hikes. And that's what is going to hit the dollar. It'll hit the dollar hard, and will tend to spike domestic inflation, which are, the Fed supposedly has been rooting for, but then they're going to get inflation beyond 2%. And that starts to have all sorts of negative effects in the markets. Gold will be nice in those circumstances, and you're going to end up with a real inflation problem. Yeah. And certainly my views are not commonplace.
Well, I got to tell you, though, that I think that we've been actually, for the last few months, back on the gold train. You know, okay. We're not gold bugs by any. As a matter of fact, I probably would be, if you say, are you neutral? Are you positive? Are you negative? I'm probably just a little left of neutral towards the negative side of gold. Just generally mm-hmm. Generally speaking, you know, I'm not a lover of it. I'm not a hater of it necessarily, but you know, if it's time, it's time. Doesn't matter. Let's make some money on something, right?
Well, I'm looking at it not just to make money on. That's I look at gold as a hedge in terms of preserving the purchasing power of the assets in it. Over time, it's the best inflation hedge that you have. And if the inflation gets real bad here, which I think it will, it's the type of thing that'll save the value of your assets more than anything else. It's liquid. It's portable. I'm talking about holding physical gold. Mm-hmm. I can see things that are going to be disruptive to the system here. I'm real.
Is this the first time you've seen this?
I tried to be realistic. I know I sound real happy here, but
yeah. is this the first time, or when did you get into this mode where you're seeing?
Oh, I've been looking at this. I've started warning about it after. Back in the second Bush administration, when the Congress did not fund its Medicare overhaul. It set it up as unfunded liabilities. Right now, we've got unfunded liabilities, net present value. It's an area that you mentioned very briefly there. Puts us up into the over $100 trillion. And that's effectively the cash you need in hand to cover it. That includes not only unfunded liabilities, but the gross federal debt. And it's there's no way the government can cover that. Run it out over time. If it's not altered, you end up with the government having to either default on its debt, which it's not going to do, or as Alan Greenspan suggested, well, you just print the money that you need to pay your obligations, which gives you a hyperinflation. And there are ways of addressing it. But what you have to watch out for here is as we get into this new system and we get some economic stimulus, it's going to, you have a lead time there before it starts to boost the economy in 2018. You're going to see some widening of the deficit. The global markets are going to start concentrating again on the U.S. deficit. And right now there's a serious long-term sovereign solvency concern. At the time, and it was involved all the negotiations over the budget deficit back in 2011. But when Standard & Poor's downgraded the treasuries, you had a dollar panic on your hands. All sorts of things were done to smooth that out. But the long-term solvency issues have to be addressed. If the new administration can address that and do something to bring the Fed's inconsistent or I don't know, but it's inconsistent, but they don't know what to do. They really are fighting a battle that they lost back in 2008. It's very difficult, not an easy solution, but the government has to do something cooperative there to try and resolve that. They bring those issues under control. And at the same time, you have a little stimulus going forward. Then you have the potential for a great boom. I just don't see the either the Fed being brought under control or the long-term solvency issues being addressed in the near term.
This is not, by the way, this is not only here. I mean, look at Europe. Europe is a disaster. Look at Japan. It's the disaster. China, the debt loads they have. I mean, we've all fed on the same set of information about, not us, I'm talking about the central banks and the governments, that just issue more debt, just just monetize the debt, just, you know, don't worry about it, just, you know, keep throwing money at the situation and make it look better and make the numbers look better. And I mean, it's really, it's a very disconcerting situation. I mean, on one hand, you know, listen, as a money manager and as an individual with money and, you know, family and saving for the future and all that, you know, I say, well, we ride the wave when we ride the wave, whether it's up or down, doesn't matter. On the other hand, you kind of back off and look at this as a quote unquote citizen, as a just a person, an observer, part of, you know, the whole entire system. You got to say, you know, why it's really kind of sad that it has to come to this, that there is so much there's so much money spent so recklessly that has, you know, created a situation where essentially, you know, we're a country that's just run on debt and just, you know, an empty checkbook.
Yeah. Well, that's going to end. That's the unfortunate thing. I mean, you mentioned very appropriately how much great shape the rest of the world is. The United States is in the worst shape in terms of magnitude of anyone. And then you're looking at the world's dominant economy. Right now, it's the dominant currency. We're not seeing strength in the currency that's commensurate with the risk in our system right now. You're going to see a sharp downside adjustment with the dollar. And when that happens, all sorts of factors are going to start piling up here, including inflation. That's one reason the Fed has been trying to keep the dollar strong. If they wanted inflation, all they had to do was encourage a weaker dollar. You've had all sorts of games going on here. You go back to the 2014 when the dollar starts to take off and oil prices collapse. Part of that, I believe, was orchestrated by the administration as an effort to put financial stress on the Russians involved with the Ukraine circumstance. It's gone well beyond that, but the that circumstance is now sort of at its extreme. The low oil prices that came with that. Now you've got OPEC looking to cut back and try and boost oil prices,
which is laughable.
But if the dollar sells off, they don't have to worry about that. That'll spike the oil prices right away.
Fix itself. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
That will fix itself.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, we're kind of out of time here. There's so much. Well, maybe we'll do this again soon because there's some great information here. Listen, we're going to put the information, some of these charts on so people can look at it. Links directly to shadowstats.com and how to get more information and become a member of John's services. But we'll make sure to have you back. This has been a fascinating, really, truly, I'm not kidding about this. It's been a fascinating discussion. And I think a lot of my listeners have been asking for you for a while, so I'm glad we finally were able to get you on.
Well, thank you.
All right.
And now just to real quickly, if they go to the website, theshadowstats.com, there's a lot of material there for non-subscribers, background material on what's happening.
Perfect. We'll make sure to have the links there, and we'll make sure to tweet it and do all sorts of fun things with it.
Okay.
All right, John, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Take care.
Well, there was a lot of things that I wanted to get to, but that was such a fascinating discussion that maybe some of it's going to have to wait till next week, because I just couldn't stop asking questions. I thought it was so interesting, many of the things that they had talked about, because we do know that there has been a significant change to the underlying methodologies that are used when it comes to statistical economic reports. And we've known that for so long time. Many people have been grousing and always really upset about the unemployment rate because it's not seemingly to be realistic, as the labor participation rate has move to levels that we haven't seen in 30, 40 years. The fact is that this inclusion of the labor participation rate in the official unemployment calculation to look at the unemployment rate has skewed it. That's what a lot of people are saying. And to a degree, we're getting some confirmation on that from John Williams and his great work as to finding what the real information is. The only problem I have is, what do we do with it? The only concern I have is, what do we do with it? Really not a problem. I do believe that the unemployment rate is probably a lot higher. The real rate of unemployment is a lot higher than what's being reported. But if all people are using this as their benchmark as to the health of the U.S. economy here and around the world, they're using the official numbers across the board to develop their economic models and their projections for economics, and they're putting that into their further calculations into what they believe should be the valuation of currencies, equity markets, bonds. And if the Fed is using a lot of this information as well to develop their outlooks in terms of how they're going to invest and what they're going to do with interest rates and what they're going to do with reinvestment of bonds and quantitative easing and monetary stimulus, et cetera, well, then it would make sense that we really look at those as the primary factors to really be the underlying movement of markets, or at least the underlying, the bedrock of what people are looking for when they are developing their market models. On the other hand, we have to keep very aware that when things start to change and they're not all as good and there's a reality check that happens, which we are seeing around the world, as we have seen with Brexit, what's happening in Europe, what's happening with the negative interest rates and the realization that these aren't so good, with the Trump election, all the things and this populist movement that's going on, maybe this is a reality check that is going to stick around for a while. Let me just close with a couple of quick things on what's going on with markets. So far this year, the top sector is the healthcare sector. This is based on the ETFs that cover these sectors, the S&P sectors. So this is all ETF based just for the first part of 2017 so far. But look at these numbers. These numbers are pretty impressive. We got the healthcare up 2.92%, consumer discretionary, even though we saw the big box retailers take a real crap. When we saw that Kohl's came out with some pretty ugly numbers, Macy's came out with some pretty nasty numbers as well, and also closing stores, Sears closing stores. So the big box retailers are having a lot of pain. Now the bullish argument is, hey, that's because of Amazon. That's because of online. That's not because people aren't buying anything, so why are we worrying? The economy is solid. Nothing to look at here. But there is something to be said that many of these retailers that have been traditionally the place to go to buy clothing and a variety of other things, with significant internet and e-commerce presence, have not been able to do well. Just keep that in the back of your head. Interesting that consumer discretionary, even with this problem that we saw last week, was up so much. Tech up 2%, materials up 185%, S&P up 1.65% for the year so far, as of today. We're talking about Sunday, January 8th. Let's see what else we have here. The worst sectors, utilities up 0.5%. Everything's up in the sectors wise. Energy up 0.75% and staples up 0.79%. The staples are the ones that are the multinationals a lot of times that will have the biggest problem with the currency headwinds, even though the dollar did come down last week. And finally, I just mentioned this, fund flows. This I thought was really interesting. TrimTabs. This is a firm that does a lot of work at calculating things like payroll data to come up with the jobs numbers. But they also do a lot of work on looking at inflows and outflows into ETFs, into mutual funds. They did a report that showed that the U.S. equity exchange traded funds, ETFs, issued a record $59.9 billion in sales in December, which surpassed the previous record of $50 billion in November. So a lot of money pouring into ETFs. They also pointed out that last year's fund flows reveal an overwhelming preference for passive U.S. equity products. Mutual funds, for the most part, which are actively managed, lost $233 billion in 2016, their third consecutive year of outflows. U.S. equity ETFs, which are primarily passively managed, had an inflow of about $169 billion, their seventh consecutive annual inflow. How do you like that? And I'll close on the fact that I did mention earlier how to get in touch with me. Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, the handle there. You can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you have not gone to thedisciplinedinvestor.com for a while, you need to go check it out. Brand new site. Totally different layout. And if you're interested in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, by the way, over on the site, there's a brand new video and virtual tour. So you can click on that. On the show notes for this show, I put some links on that. But I really like to have you go over to the site and check it out. There's some really cool things there. Well, with that in mind, hopefully you're bundling up for the cold weather that we've had recently. I want to thank you for joining me. Hoping to see you again real soon next week when we have Harry Dent as a guest. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.